Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and all the best of this week's culture and files. This week, Paddy Woodworth relitigates whether in fact Kropotkin was a crackpot in the Naturalist bookshelf. Tyga O'Sullivan floats in with his latest Cloud of Unknowing, and the voices behind a performance of Stockhausen's epic Stimmung talk about working with the late German composer. But we start this week with the outsized paw print of cats in the online world, as Jennifer Walsh avidly follows the activity of a highly popular neighborhood individual. What does the explosion of animal tracking possibilities mean about the watching humans? Wonders the composer in her latest Things Know Things.
I recently joined my neighborhood WhatsApp chat. It's a pretty active chat. There are over 300 members, which I guess is what happens when you live in a densely populated city. The neighborhood chat is full of useful information, from recommendations for locksmiths to where people leave cuttings from their plants for others to take. It's where I found out about the recent auroras, my phone exploding late one night with photographs, screenshots from Aurora Watch UK, and exhortations to run to a window and look north. One of my neighbours has a cat, let's call the cat Rocky, who became so popular on the neighbourhood chat that a separate chat had to be created just for his fans. Yes, of course I'm on this chat, along with about 70 other people. Why is Rocky so popular? Sure, he's a cute cat, but much more importantly, he is very friendly and, as is a cat's right, seems to regard the entire neighbourhood as his personal domain. How do I know this? Because none of the pictures on Rocky fans are taken by his owner. All the pictures are taken by the many, many people who Rocky visits each day. And that is why the Rocky fans chat is fascinating to me. Not because it supplies endless pics of a cute cat, but because it gives me a sense of how a cat lives. Here is Rocky at 5 a.m. in the morning, having his back massaged by a toddler in one house. Here is Rocky at mid-morning, lazing on a kitchen table in a different house. Here he is again and again in so many different flats and houses, trying to break into the bathroom, napping on someone's bedroom pillow, grooming himself on the hall mat, having his portrait drawn by a child. This is a case where technology offers me something beautiful, a glimpse into how a non-human navigates the world. The artist and technologist James Bridle argues for this way of knowing other creatures in his book Ways of Being. Bridle calls for an Internet of Animals, a philosophical approach whereby technology is used as a gesture of communication, of care, to allow non-human species to demonstrate what they need from us humans. Bridle gives the example of Animal Tracker, a fantastic free app created by the Max Planck Institute, which allows you to see the flight paths of different birds who have been fitted with trackers. I open up Animal Tracker and I watch time lapses of a starling's flight between the Netherlands and London, a yellow-legged gull's wanderings between the south of France and Cornwall in the UK. A black kite's migration from northern Italy down the western coast of Africa and into Mali. Forget Instagram. Animal Tracker is where it's at. I feel deep joy every time I use it. The Rocky fans chat functions as a low-tech, crowdsourced version of Animal Tracker, where the focus is firmly on one cat. It offers the same insights and the same joy. And what's clear is that just like the birds, Rocky doesn't observe borders. He needs freedom. He needs space to roam, more space than you could ever imagine. The chat allows Rocky to advocate for his rights as a cat, without ever having to do anything other than be his fabulous self.
Jennifer Walsh there on the rise of animal tracking in her latest Things Know Things. And if you haven't yet, try searching CatCam on TikTok to join some eye-opening journeys with Rocky's friends and relations. Now, this weekend, Dundalk has been home to the latest summer festival of new music from Louth Contemporary Music Society, called Lovely Music. This was the event that last year hosted the astounding Irish trad performance of Terry Riley's In C. And if you missed our special programme on that, it's available now on the Culturefile podcast feed. Do check it out. One of this year's highlights will be a performance of Stockhausen's massive improvisation for six vocalists, Stimmung. As with Riley's In C, the compositional approach here means that no two performances are exactly alike. Performing the piece in Dundalk this weekend are Neue Vokale Solisten, one of the ensemble that worked directly with Stockhausen on the piece, as the groups Andreas Fischer and Guillermo Ensereña told Culturefile's Niamh Daly.
We give our voices to the composers. They can use it in any way they imagine, with air. Body percussion things like something like that, and this is when you use the head. My name is Andreas Fischer. I'm the bass of the group, Neue Vokalsolisten Stuttgart. They are connected with the group since the end of the 80s.
My name is Guillermo Ensereña. I'm from Argentina, but I've been in Germany for the past 30 years. I'm a baritone, and I've been singing with the guys for the past 23 years. I'm a lyrical baritone, but very light voice. I did my studies in normal singing, and then I got corrupt by this contemporary music, and I started to sing crazy things.
Well, we corrupted him. Yeah, I'm quite, let's say, infected by contemporary music. So I like to work with living composers, creating always new things, new artistic things together with the composer. And this is, yeah, what I really like in our work.
Conosco il mio povero babbo, ma è sempre vivo, è sempre vivo.
So often the voice is only used as an instrument, like a keyboard or a clarinet, and we are used only to sing single pitches and notes. Some of the composers have a special connection to voice and singing. For example, Salvatore Sciarrino, he knows really very well how voice really develops in space and also in time. We are founded in something like 1984. We mostly work with six or sometimes seven singers, cast of high soprano, lyric soprano, alto, tenor, baritone and bass, and sometimes countertenor. And the base of our work is to work in a democratic way, because we are all experienced singers and we have very different characters. So we are, if you have two or three different opinions about intonation, you cannot make a compromise. But finally, we always have a decision, and sometimes I really don't know how and why we decided for this or for that. It's really funny.
Stimmung from Stimme, which is voice, but mood. You can say, ja, wir haben eine gute Stimmung. We are in a good mood today. So it's kind of a invitation to melt, to get to a fusion in a sounding world through overtones, through harmonics. And it's quite a big challenge. Every voice is very, very different. And you have to try to be one, to get in a state of fusion and unify the energies, the voices, the overtones.
So we have a quite long history with this piece. We worked the piece with the composer, with Stockhausen himself. Every time it's completely different because there is no final score of the piece, and we love to sing it because it's really a beautiful piece and a piece of the 70s, I have to say. It's really connected to the spiritual, special world of the 70s, where free love and all those things were important in art. And the other thing is the connection to the cosmos. And I think maybe also taking drugs while making art. This was all in the 70s quite, yeah, part of the artistic experience.
I think the whole thing is kind of being, you know, in a being high together with the music.
So we don't take drugs. we do not take drugs before we sing the piece because. Maybe it would be a nice experiment to try this, but until now we did not. it's funny how Stockhausen found this, because when he wrote the piece in the 70s, he was a young father, so he has a young baby at home. He was composing, but he had to compose very silent because the baby was sleeping. And then he was singing like, and the softer you sing, the better you hear the overtones. And then he discovered the world of overtones just because he had to sing so soft.
Yeah.
And so this is, the reason why the piece Stimmung is existing.
Yeah.
Because of the baby.
Andreas Fischer and Guillermo Ensareña of Neue Vokale Solisten there. Niamh Daly was the reporter. And the NVS will be performing Stimmung in St. Nicholas Church of Ireland, Dundalk, tonight as part of the Lovely Music Festival. For his latest selection for an ideal shelf of nature writing, Paddy Woodworth has thumbed through to an essay by evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould. Originally published in 1988, Gould's Kropotkin Was No Crackpot re-examined the biophilosophy of Russian noble-turned-anarchist Peter Alexeyevich Kropotkin, who questioned whether survival of the fittest really told the whole story of the natural world. This is the Naturalist Bookshelf.
A phrase that was comforting to many of us during the COVID pandemic, just follow the science, begs several questions. Taken literally, it represents a fundamental misunderstanding of the scientific method. It suggests that science is made up of fixed facts that laypeople should accept as eternally true, whereas good science is based on the idea that every theory, no matter how strongly supported by what we know now, may need to be adapted, perhaps even discarded, as new evidence emerges. So yes, it's wise to listen to the views of the most qualified scientists before you take a decision, especially during a pandemic. But you will often find that the scientists themselves may disagree, depending not only on the facts they can establish, but on how they interpret those facts. And that interpretation, especially in the realm of big ideas, will be shaped to some degree by the dominant ideology of the societies they live in. Moreover, scientific language itself is often expressed through colourful metaphors that tilt meanings in ways we need to be more conscious of. It's surely no coincidence that the phrase most associated with Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, survival of the fittest, reflects very closely the ideology of unregulated capitalism that was paramount in his England. In one of his many entertaining, insightful, and above all enjoyable essays, the distinguished evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould makes illuminating comparisons between Darwin's work and language and those of a much lesser-known contemporary of Darwin's, Peter Kropotkin. This essay reminds us that even the theory of evolution remains a work in progress. In Kropotkin Was No Crackpot, published some 30 years ago, Gould re-examines the Russian writer's book, Mutual Aid, A Factor in Evolution. Kropotkin argued that cooperation is at least as big an influence on the survival of species, and indeed individuals, as competition. Many Western scientists dismissed, and still dismiss, Kropotkin's work. They say it's just a projection of his own personal political ideology onto nature. And indeed, rather surprisingly, since he was born a prince, Kropotkin was a leading Russian anarchist, committed to building a society based on, precisely, cooperation for the common good. And cooperation is a taboo word for many evolutionary biologists. They say it commits the almost unpronounceable sin of anthropomorphism, that is, transferring human traits to the natural world. But let's turn the tables for a moment and look at the language used by the same Darwinian scientists. They are perfectly comfortable using the word competition, derived from the ideology of free market capitalism that inevitably influenced Darwin's writings. In fairness, though, Darwin was much more nuanced about his use of competition than many of his disciples are. As Gould points out, Darwin explicitly wrote that the struggle for existence was a metaphor. Darwin also clearly understood that that struggle could not be reduced entirely to the bloody gladiatorial battles we so often see highlighted on TV nature programmes. It was at least as much a struggle to adapt to challenging and changing environmental conditions. So Gould does not argue that Kropotkin was right and Darwin was wrong. Indeed, he's deeply sceptical about our urge to project our prejudices and desires, whatever they may be, onto the natural world. He would no doubt find currently popular books extolling cooperation in nature, like The Secret Life of Trees, fuzzy and overblown. Instead, he shows that Kropotkin was as serious and meticulous a scientist as Darwin was. He based his emphasis on cooperation over competition in evolution not so much because of his personal political worldview, but because of the evidence he was studying. And it was at least partly because the evidence that both men studied was so different that their conclusions about the nature of evolution have such different emphases. Darwin's research focused very much on the tropics, where species diversity is greatest, and therefore the competition for resources and ecological niches is indeed often very intense and very visible. On the other hand, Kropotkin and like-minded Russian scientists focused on Siberian ecosystems, where much more challenging environments lead to fewer species and more visible cooperation or mutual aid between them. Both these men blazed illuminating trails, and as contemporary research reveals more and more patterns of cooperation within and between species, especially at the subsoil level, literally the foundation of all life on Earth. These trails are converging. As Gould concludes, perhaps cooperation and mutual aid are the more common results of the struggle for existence. Perhaps communion, rather than combat, leads to greater reproductive success in most circumstances. Or, in Kropotkin's own words, sociability is as much a law of nature as mutual struggle. Gould has the gift of making these complex topics accessible to the general reader by expressing them in humane, witty, and enjoyable language. Above all, his work is infused with the sense of wonder that is the essential spark that connects good science and the love of nature. Following the science should not lead us to dogmatic certainties, but to ask more questions, to wonder more and more at the world around us.
Paddy Woodworth there on Stephen Jay Gould's Kropotkin Was No Crackpot, which you'll find in many places online. But if you'd like to add it physically to the bookshelf with all of Paddy's other selections, it's available in Gould's collection, Bully for Brontosaurus, Reflections in Natural History. And finally this week, more stirrings in the vicinity of the bookshelves. While Paddy Woodworth was running a finger along the Naturalist bookshelf in County Wicklow, on the flip side in County Clare, Tige O'Sullivan too has been examining some old, familiar, sometimes unloved volumes in his latest Cloud of Unknowing.
I'm not quite sure where they came from. They always seem to have been there. 21 books. Their thick white spines each had three small squares, one with a number, one with one or more letters, one with a stylized tree, all in gold against a deep blue. Also in gold, written at a right angle to the horizontal, such that you had to tilt your head to read it properly, the new book of knowledge. The books were kept on the bottom shelf of a bookcase. The fit was so strangely perfect that it gave to my impressionable young mind an august air of completeness. There was no room for any more. This was all the knowledge. I was not a great reader of fiction as a child, but for me these encyclopedia, with their thousands of pages, contained entire worlds. Maps and articles about distant lands were the first to draw me in. The European countries familiar from school maps, the American states, all with their own entries, their strange straight-line borders and exotic state birds. The Soviet republics, their diversity and humanity entirely at odds with the version of Russia that came through the television in this weird Cold War era.
Here's the pitch by Downing, swinging, there's a drive into left.
There were languages, lost civilizations, strange sports, assassinations, scientific discoveries, writers, art, technology, entire industries I'd never heard of, articles about bullfighting, electricity, the Virgin Mary, polio, metallurgy, funeral customs, the moon, bird migration, Marie Curie, Iceland, folk tales, Connecticut, ventriloquism, Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich, and John.
And our strength. We can have a strong and prosperous America at peace with itself and the world.
It was all terribly serious, in a way that deeply impressed me. Younger listeners might be intrigued to know how disconnected it all was from the commercial realm. There were no ads, no sponsored articles. The first few pages about, say, cycling were not made up of ads for bicycles or Lycra shorts. 10 minutes browsing an article about boats did not lead to people following you down the street or appearing at your bedroom window for the next few days, showing you canoe catalogues. Knowledge was stable and mostly written by scholars in the appropriate field. It was not likely that returning to an article after a few days, one would find that it had been changed by an anonymous editor with a zealous, jealous interest in the subject. In time, this stability tipped into obsolescence. At the end of 40 sketches of old white men, the President of the United States stubbornly remained Ronald Reagan. The World Cup champions were forever Italy, triumphant in the final over West Germany. West Germany would always be, well, West Germany. Absences and lacks, too, captured the book's specific moment and particular worldview. There were no articles on the American Empire or on cultural imperialism, such as might shed light on why a boy in rural Ireland was reading an American book to learn about Algeria. Music and movies, which were rapidly becoming my main interests and windows onto the wider world, were dealt with in a way that, to quote Morrissey, in time, the books rarely moved from their shelf, a barely noticed fixture in a house where little ever changed. They became less books and more like objects, heavy things that might be placed on one's lap to do a crossword, or for a grandchild to lean on when drawing. A newspaper clipping or a note might be slipped between the pages for safekeeping. Flowers from sweethearts from funerals were pressed to be kept and forgotten, lost somewhere between the Aztecs and the Industrial Revolution. The spines cracked and the books seemed to sag and grow somewhat, perhaps with these additions, perhaps from age. They had spent some 30 years in the same room, had watched children grow up and leave, come back and visit with other children who had an entirely new relationship with learning and books. They had been swept daily by the summer sun moving through the room and huddled together in the winter drafts. They had overheard thousands of conversations, listened to countless hours of films and television, been privy to minor and major family dramas. They didn't seem to fit their bookcases neatly anymore. S would spend a year on another shelf. JK would go missing for a while. When the time came to clear out the house, it took me a few hours to pack them into boxes. I was drawn down a series of rabbit holes. Articles that were simply interesting. Others that evoked a strange and magnetic nostalgia. The colours, the textures of the pages themselves drew me back to a time when my own world was remarkably small, while the larger world beyond it seemed both finite and, in theory at least, understandable. In Walter Benjamin's essay, Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, he explores his idea of the aura, an ineffable air that attaches to original works of art and distinguishes them from printed copies. This aura, for Benjamin, derived from an original work's authenticity, its uniqueness and history, its role in ritual. I sometimes think that in time, with enough of a connection to human life and its small domestic rituals, such an aura can form around the most ordinary things, such as a set of mechanically reproduced books sold by travelling salesmen to families who may or may not have been able to afford to invest in knowledge as a luxury good. I sometimes think that this aura is itself a form of knowledge, a private and deeply human knowledge, and one that cannot be reproduced.
Tygo Sullivan's Cloud of Unknowing there, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more gracefully degrading certainty next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.